Take your Bibles and turn to Ephesians chapter 4, please. Ephesians chapter 4. Several years ago, there was a television show that was pretty common entitled The Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous. And I can still hear, some of you may even know his name. I can't remember the guy's name, but he was an Englishman. And he would come on talking about the lifestyles, and he would show the houses of rich people and their car collections and all that they had. And I can remember several years ago looking at that and thinking, my goodness, how great it would be to be able to have houses like that and cars like that. That money would never be a concern. Man, it'd be unbelievable. The older I get, the more I realize that many times money can cause as many problems as it can solve them. Now, don't get me wrong. Don't misunderstand me. I think money is needed to live on. It's kind of like Joe Lewis. I'm not in love with money necessarily. It just tends to quiet my nerves. And I find that to be true in my own life. You certainly want money to pay the bills. I'm not saying that. But I will say that money does not bring happiness at all. It certainly did not purchase it for many people, even that you saw on that particular television show. However, I find that many Christians are caught up in trying to live that lifestyle of the rich and famous, when God has not called us to that at all. God has promised to take care of our needs. We certainly ought to have a work ethic. We'll even be looking at that later in this passage that we'll be addressing tonight. God certainly called upon us to take care of our finances. But God has not called us or promised us that we would be rich or famous, regardless of what some theological persuasions try to teach us in today's Christian world. God has promised to take care of our needs. That's what He has promised to do. What we ought to be consumed with is not so much living the lifestyle of the rich and famous, as much as David Jeremiah put it in his book, living a lifestyle of being righteous and faithful. When we get to the end of our life, when we stand at the judgment seat of Christ, you will not hear one person being addressed by the Creator of the universe and the Redeemer of our souls in this way: "Well done, thou rich and famous person." What you will hear, however, is, "Well done, thou good, righteous, and faithful servant." So the calling and the aspiration of the believer's life is not to be rich and famous. And quite frankly, I think we should take it farther than that. I think we need to be very careful at who we place as heroes, people that we honor and respect in our life, because you watch, the people that we admire are the people that we aspire to become. Young people, I want to encourage you. You want to get a fat head? Get a fat head of great preachers. There's plenty of preachers that have fat heads. You ought to get those that you put up on your wall, men you aspire to be, that are more like Jesus Christ. Where does that come from? It comes from watching parents. We put in front of them, well, you know, they have money. And we almost give this implied respect and honor to people that for whatever reason have money and or power. We have to be very careful of that, because unconsciously or subconsciously, we can find ourselves deeming what's most important to be unimportant in our life. And that's to live a righteous life and a faithful life before God. Let me put it to you this way. I would much rather live with a large mansion in heaven for eternity and a small cottage here on earth than a large mansion here on earth and not much reward in heaven. God's called us to a certain lifestyle, and that lifestyle is to be righteous and it's to be faithful. We know it's through His grace, but God's called us to surrender our life so He can work in our life. And there's some evidences, there's some distinctions for a Christian that ought to be present in their life. When you read Ephesians chapter 4, we're going to be looking at verses 25 through 32. That's it. There are five distinctions that you ought to be looking for in your life. Now, we say, well, you know, sometimes we consider these works as marks of spirituality. I will say this, you know, it's as the Word of God speaks, "You show me your faith without your works, I'll show you my faith by my works." A person who believes in God will enact the things of God in his life. There's not a single person alive that can love and trust God that's also not obedient to Him. And so these things, these evidences, these distinctions ought to be in our lives. And I want you to listen very closely. What I'm about to say may come over in a harsh way, but it's things that need to be addressed. So tonight, let's just step through this passage. The first distinction that a Christian ought to find in their life of living a lifestyle of being righteous and faithful is found in verse 25. And that is the distinction of our morality. Notice if you will, verse 25. Wherefore, putting away lying, speak every man truth with his neighbor, for we are members one of another. Our morality, the way that we live our life, ought to be distinctively different than the world around us. What we hold to be true, what we hold to be untrue, ought to be distinctively different than the world around us. Well, Pastor, what do you mean? Well, many times we redefine God. When we redefine God, we also redefine what God deems to be right and what God deems to be wrong. Let me tell you one of the things that greatly bothers me now as a pastor. I watch that many Christians see sexual purity as being something that God obviously does not deem that important anymore. Well, Pastor, I think that God deems that important. Really? Then why has it become so casual? Not in the world, in the church. It's become something very casual for us. It is without fail that I get wind. Nobody comes to the pastor and says, I just want to let you know. You get wind. Well, so-and-so, this happened, and so-and-so, they slept with this person, and so-and-so. Where is the outrage that we find coming internally in this area of morality before God? God has never changed His ways for us. God has never changed the truth of His Word for us. And yet, I watch couples that are not married who say, well, you know, it's not a big deal. Let me ask you a question. How is God going to bless your marriage if you have never respected God in your relationship up to this point? Let me put it to you just a little more plainly. If Junior was unfaithful before marriage, he was willing to sleep with a woman that wasn't married, then, dear young lady, what makes you think that once he crosses the aisle, he's going to be faithful just because of a few words he said at a marriage altar? I think that's something you ought to think about. Because here's the issue. Well, you know, he was unfaithful. Here's how it comes. He was unfaithful with me. It's almost like I'm watching the movie Enchanted. It's just so beautiful. No, it's sinful. There's no other way for you to explain it. Now, let me ask you a question. If he was unfaithful in being obedient to God before marriage, why are you so convinced he's going to be faithful in being obedient to God after marriage? So you hand it all casually now. The pastor steps onto the scene, and nobody likes to talk to the pastor now. He's the bad guy in what happens in these areas. You know, they killed prophets in the Old Testament. But the fact is, I've seen this work itself out time after time after time. Listen to me, parents. You minimize sin in your life and your young people's lives, they're going to minimize it when they get on their own. I'm not saying there's not forgiveness in Jesus Christ. I'm not saying there's not grace and mercy. But there ought to be something distinctively different about our lives than the world that is lived around us. And yet when people watch our lives, there's no difference in the way we live our life. We sleep with who we want to sleep with. But we're committed to each other. It's not an issue of you being committed to each other. It's an issue of you being committed to God. I'm committed in the area of morality, not because of you. I'm committed in the area of morality because of my commitment to God. I don't limit myself of who I sleep with because I'm committed to them. That's the whole argument about same-sex unions today. The point of who I sleep with is based on my commitment to God. There ought to be a distinctive in a believer's life. It continues on. Let's just go straight to the text for this. It's talking about the issue of lying. Christians, the way we do business ought to be different than the world around us. The way we handle ourselves ought to be different than the world around us. It used to be able to be said that, well, you know, I love working in the company we work in because the company we work in, we have Christians all around us. I thought that was true till I worked in a company that had Christians all around me. And then I found out that many times Christians can rationalize their way into doing things because God's mercy is ever present. So as long as I go to confession on Saturday, or that's the mindset, then it's okay to lie, to cheat, to steal. It's okay, because that's the way business gets done. I want to encourage you with something. The world ought to be able to see you losing money in order to maintain a holy integrity in your life. I believe God's big enough to honor Him in that way. In our lives, we ought to be putting away lying. I don't know how else to tell us this, but God's not playing games in this area of morality. I particularly watch those that when I say those kind of things, they get kind of this glaze over the eye. Here's how it works. Let me show you. Ready? You don't have to say it to me. Can he just get on to the next point? Maybe the saving grace is he'll tell a funny story in here somewhere. Maybe a tearjerker. But can we just please get on with it? All right? We'll just get on with it, but let me remind you, be not deceived. God is not mocked. Whatsoever man soweth, that shall he also reap. I praise the Lord for the class, our college and career class, that they got out at and made the contacts that they made. That was very exciting. But young people, I want to be very clear with you because you live in a society that is wholly given to the flesh. God's not going to give you a pass on immorality. He's not going to do it. You build your relationships with the opposite sex. You build that on a physical relationship. That's all you're going to have. And let me tell you, after 20, 25 years, you're not going to have much left. You're not going to have much left. And because you built it on a faulty foundation, you're always going to be wondering, if they were unfaithful to God with me, then will they be unfaithful to me with others? Yes. You can't just turn that on a dime. At some point, that person has to surrender to God in an area of morality. Pastor, I don't believe you. We're in love. Okay. But mark my words, I'll be there at the other end of it. I'll love you through it. But there ought to be distinction of morality in our lives. It ought to be marked in our lives. That person is different. When you're at the job place, young people, when you're at the job place, the way you conduct yourself, say, well, I tell you, the answer is to get them in a Christian school. No. I believe in Christian education, but I've seen Christian school kids. I was one of them. I hear the conversation. Christian school, young person, has to be intent on being a moral person before God as much as anybody else. I've seen the sorriest, most perverted jokes come out of Christian school kids. Your circumstances do nothing to change your heart. Our morality ought to be something that is distinctively Christian in our lives. He continues on. Not only should our morals be distinctive as the lifestyles of righteous and faithful people, but secondly, our moods ought to be distinctive. Look at verse 26. It says, be ye angry. I underline those three words, be ye angry. Because I have some Christians that say, well, you ought never get angry. You should never get worked up. You should always be kind and gentle and loving. And you should never raise your voice. That's not true. It's hard for me to picture Jesus Christ not having raised his voice when he has a bullwhip turning over tables in the outer court of the temple. I don't want to interrupt you right now, but I'm going to turn your table over if that's okay with you. And I have this little whip in my hand. There's a point of being angry. I watch Christians try to redefine Christianity by saying you should never be angry. You should never be angry. How dare you be angry? It's the feminization of Christianity. That is not true in Scripture. It says, be angry. But I also want you to underline the next three words. And sin not. Where does anger become sinful? Anger becomes sinful at the point that it moves in to a place of rage. Did you know psychologists would tell you that rage really is a temporary form of insanity? And I'll tell you who's most given to this. And let me tell you, because I am one of those. The ones who are most given to this are those who like to have control. We like to have everything just lined up exactly right. I'm going to clue you in on something that I have to learn every single day of my life. In case you're wondering, you and I are never really in control. I don't care what you're the boss of. You're never really in control. And as long as you live underneath that delusion, you're going to constantly find a rageful anger as a part of your personality. For me, I can tell you, that's one of those key signs for me. When I get angry very quickly and very unreasonably, that's a key sign for me that my spiritual life is not in the place that it should be. Because the fact is, it's not my control. It's God's control. And so there's some things I just have to hand over to Him. And that's the reason at the end of that verse, when it says, "Be ye angry and sin not," and it says, "Let not the sun go down upon your wrath." We say, well, that means that you ought not to be mad at anybody. And don't go to sleep if you're still angry with someone. That is not true. Otherwise, you're going to have some very long nights. The issue that you let not the sun go down upon your wrath is this issue of rage that you're out of control. And that you're willing to allow yourself to go into this rage based on the fact that you have this idea that somehow you should be in control. That's the part you need to let go. God, before I lay my head on my pillow tonight, I'm handing this over to you. I'm not going to consume, obsess over it. I'm not going to find myself tossing sleeplessly over it. Lord, it's your problem. In the morning, we'll address it. But I will say, our moods ought to be distinctive. I'm speaking to myself tonight. There ought to be some way, not that we shouldn't be angry, never misunderstand this. There ought to be some things that we get worked up over. I wish we had more fathers that would get worked up over more things. I'm very serious about it. I wish we had dads that would get angrier about some things. Moms as well. That they would get to the point that they would look at Junior, who they're paying for their food and their clothes and their bedding, and they're paying for everything that pertains to their life, for their car, their insurance, and even the job that they have is for play money for them, which is very unrealistic. And yet then they'll turn to them and they'll say, "I'm going to live life on my own. Who are you?" I go into houses and I'll see these signs on the door of a young person's room that'll say, "Private property, no trespassing." I just want to go in unannounced just to do it. And if I walk in, "How dare you come into this room?" "I'm sorry. I should have asked the person that owns the house, shouldn't I?" And that's not you either, is it? See, parents, we need to be careful that we say, well, anger ought never to be present. Because it should be present. There's some things we should get angry about. But there's also some things that we need to be very careful that we should not be angry about. And we certainly should not go into this rage and this fury that somehow we're losing control. In the end, it's still God's. He's still sovereign. Our moods ought to be different. Our morality ought to be different. Our moods ought to be different. It continues on. Verse 27, he says, "Neither give place to the devil." When you allow rage to work in your life, you're giving the devil an open door to get into your life. Number three, a distinctive for a Christian lifestyle of righteous and faithful is our morality, our moods. Thirdly, verse 28, our money. It says, "Let him that stole steal no more, but rather let him labor, working with his hands the thing which is good, that he may have to give to him that needeth." There's three parts of the money issue brought up in verse 28 of Ephesians chapter 4. Number one, you ought to be honest in your dealings with money. Let him that steal stole, steal no more. Well, Pastor, I don't steal. Can I tell you a part of stealing? A part of stealing to me is when you make an agreement that you're going to work this number of hours for this amount of money. And you don't do that. Because of delinquency, because of daydreaming. Let me tell you something. I'm amazed today when a person shows up late to work that it's the boss's problem for getting upset about it. Instead of the employee's problem to go to that boss and say, I am sorry I'm late. And if he disciplines them, that somehow he's an unfair person. No, no, listen to me very closely. You're the one who broke your agreement, not him. The agreement was you show up at this time and you clock out at this time. And you work in between those two times. You're the one that broke the agreement, not him. So it ought to be you asking for forgiveness. It ought to be you initiating the dialogue of trying to repair the work relationship that you have compromised. Instead, we dare the boss to say anything about it. We dare the boss to bring it up. And we wonder why we stay at the bottom of the totem pole of the workspace. Is it any wonder? See, there's many ways to steal. We're in tax season. Christians, we can do amazing things when it comes to tax time and rationalize that it's okay to steal. It's not okay to steal. It's not. If you're cheating on your taxes and you're crossing your fingers hoping, well, I just hope the IRS never finds out about this. Lord, please fill me with your Holy Spirit. Just don't let the IRS call. How can you allow that to happen in your life? I'm serious. God will not work through a dirty vessel. In the area of our money, we ought to be distinctive. When we find out the IRS is coming to audit us, the thing that we most ought to worry about is just the bother, the worry of trying to find everything to get it together. Man, I hate doing it, but I'm not worried. I've done every single thing that I need to do. The boss wants to check up on me? That's no problem. I have no problem with accountability because I know how I deal in the workspace. Let him that steals, stole steal no more. It continues on. It's not just in the area of stealing that we ought to be distinctive in the area of money, but he continues on. It says, working with his hands, that which is good. Your work ethic ought to be something to be spoken of. You ought to have a healthy work ethic. If you read the book of Proverbs teaches that. I was talking with someone, it's been a few months ago, and this was a statement. He goes, Pastor, you know, I can get this job, and they'll basically pay the same as what I get in unemployment. So I'm really kind of struggling with what I should do. What do you think I should do? In other words, do you want to go out and earn the money and have the ability as a man to lay your head on your pillow at night and say that I put in a good day's work for a good day's wage? Or you're wanting me to pay your paycheck? Is that what you're asking me? Well, now that you put it, no, that is the way it is. Now, let me ask you a question. 7 or 8 months from now, when all of a sudden unemployment plays itself out, which I don't think is ever going to happen, what then? What if that job's not there then? What then? I think for a Christian, we ought to be marked by a good work ethic. I think it's a part of spiritual Christ-like character. You read the book of Proverbs. The book of Proverbs pulls no punches on a sluggard. Pulls no punches on a lazy person. Why should I mean, there's really nothing for me to do. Look, if you don't have a job, go do something. Go find something to do. Cut grass at a widow's house. The one thing you ought to find yourself doing is not having people ask the question, what do they do all day with their time? Have you ever seen guys like that? You look at the way they live their life every day and you just wonder, what exactly is it that they are doing all day every day? I mean, what is going on in their life? I don't want that said about my life. I'd much rather have it be said, I don't know how he's doing it all. Not because he's trying to be some superhuman, but I think that godliness compels us to have a good work ethic. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with rest. I think there's times of being overwhelmed. You need to take a come apart and rest a while. I think that's very much a part of it. I think we have diluted the idea of Sabbath to the point that we become workaholics in a very spiritually unhealthy way in our lives. But we ought to be about a good work ethic. Why? He gives the last part of that in money. That he may have to give to him that needeth. You know why we ought to have a good work ethic? So we can give more. Not so we can have more. See, we have it completely opposite as a believer. The lifestyle of the rich and famous is you work harder so you can have more. The lifestyle of the righteous and faithful is that we work more so we can give more. I was talking with a gentleman in a church here, and he was talking to me about a business proposition. And as he was talking to me, it had some great promise. And he said, "Pastor, I hope this works out, because I want to tell you something. I want to be able to give more than I've ever given before. I want to be able to say, Lord, I'm giving as much as I can possibly to you." Now, I have to tell you something. God will reward a prayer like that. If it's not a self-absorbed prayer, God rewards that when he gets the glory for it. We ought to be distinctive in the way that we handle our money. We ought to be distinctive in our moods, in our morality. Number 4, verse 29, we ought to be distinctive with our mouths. Verse 29, "Let no corrupt communication proceed out of your mouth, but that which is good to the use of edifying, that it may minister grace unto the hearers." What is he saying here? Mark every single word. Here's the question you have to ask yourself. Is your mouth in your heart, or is your heart in your mouth? For many of us, our heart's in our mouth. What do I mean by that? It means everything we think, we say. Have you ever ran into those people, as I've asked before? Most people are built with just this built-in filter that says, "I'm going to think about this before I say it." Some people have a genetic disorder that ability has been removed from their life. So everything they think, when I was a coach, one of the things you'd always tell the ball players is a mistake. You see it and you do it. If you see the opening, you see it, you do it. Here's where you're making your mistake. You're seeing it, then you're thinking about it, and then you're doing it. By that point, it's too late. When you see that opening, you see it, you do it. Don't sit there and think about it, because in the time it takes you to think about it, you're going to find yourself losing that opportunity. So you see it and you do it. Let me tell you what that should not work with. It shouldn't work with the words that proceed out of our mouth. When it comes into your conscious mind, this is what I perceive the situation to be. Before that comes out of your mouth, just take a few moments and think about what you're about to say. And here's the question you ask yourself. Is this going to build up that person? Is it going to produce grace in their life? Now, this is coming from someone who has given very much to a sarcastic tone. I've read that some of the smartest people are very good with sarcasm. So maybe I'm that smart. But if we're that smart, then listen to me. Those of us who are so quick-witted, your quick tongue, boy, you can put somebody in their place. In fact, you just revel in it. Oh, man, just bring it on. I'm going to set you up. It's going to checkmate so quick. I can't wait. And you even have that gleam in your eye. Come on, just say one more thing, because I got you. I mean, you are setting me up. It's too easy, I know, but I'm still going to take it. I want it. If you're so smart with your words, then can you also apply wisdom to your intelligence? I don't need to have the last word. There are some marriages in here that are falling apart. You're wearing your coat and tie. You're wearing your skirt and dress. You're looking very nice, very presentable for everyone. But your marriage is falling apart. Because you have two parties, at least one party, that you have to have the last word. You've always got to win. You've always got to have the one up. You can never admit wrong. You're always going to be the victor in the argument at all costs. And it's killing your marriage. It's destroying it. There ought to be something very distinctive about the Christian and the lifestyles of the righteous and famous in the way that we use our tongue. May our words be parsed with grace. May they build people up when we speak to them. I'm reading a book right now, and I've read it several times. You ever read the book, How to Win Friends and Influence People? There's been over 40 million copies sold. Dale Carnegie wrote it in 1936. You ought to read it. He opens it up by talking about how people refuse to see their own faults. If you don't believe that, you ought to get in jail ministry. There are no guilty people in jail. There's always a reason why they've done what they've done. But it's not just in jail that's true. You ever gotten in an argument with your spouse? They're never wrong either. And you know why they're never wrong? Because you're never wrong. What good does that produce now? What good has it produced? Now what's happened is, brick by brick, you have built up this wall of bitterness in your marriage. When you could have it, you could have a beautiful relationship, but now you can't. Because these words have built up over time. And now that's the reason you argue over the same old things over and over. The words are just there to win. They're not there to solve a thing. For the lifestyle of the righteous and faithful, our morality ought to be distinctive. Our moods, our money, our mouths, and lastly, our manners ought to be distinctive. Look at verse 31. It says, let all bitterness, wrath, anger, clamor, and evil speaking be put away from you with all malice. In other words, there's something that we ought to put off. Colossians 3 really hits on this, on putting off the old man, putting on the new man. But as Christians, we ought to be putting off a basic attitude of meanness in our life. Somebody said to me this morning, a new believer, she said to me at the very end, she goes, Pastor, man, I really enjoyed the service. And for the first time in a long time, she goes, I actually sat under preaching that I could understand. She goes, I understood what you were talking about. Most preaching I hear, I don't understand what they're saying. They're talking over my head. And I told her, I said, hey, look, that's one of the greatest compliments you can give to a preacher. He may not see it that way, but it's one of the greatest compliments. I said, my goal is always to preach at my level, and then I figure most people can understand that. So here's a very easy concept. You ought to put off meanness in your life. The fact is, some of us are just mean. We're just mean people. We're just mean. Can I tell you something about me? In my spiritual struggle, you can always tell when I'm wandering from the Lord. You know why? Because I can just be mean. No other purpose to it, just mean. And you know who that shows up with first? My family. I'm telling you, I've grown up in the Christian world my entire life. There are times that I've struggled greatly with resentment and rebellion. And the times that I look back and I struggled most with resentment and rebellion, it was founded on this idea that I watched Christians being very mean to one another. The church here is Independent Baptist. There's a reason that we're Independent Baptist, both of those. There's a reason why we believe in the New Testament local church. So we're independent. We're Baptist by belief. I believe that the Word of God speaks very clearly. I choose to believe that. But just because we're Independent Baptist does not mean that it gives us license to be mean-spirited people. But for whatever reason, within our ranks, I have found growing up that somehow we pride ourselves on being mean. No. That ought not to be. You know, I've really just come to a deal with a lot of other ministries in the area. Here's my deal. I'm going to leave you alone. I'm just going to leave you alone. I'm just asking one thing. Leave me alone. You let me serve God in Somerville, Alabama, the way God's called Somerville Baptist Church to do. You want to do your thing? Then you do your thing. You want to follow God? You do it your way. And following God. But I'm going to follow God in the way that I see Him leading me in the Word. But invariably, we have to try to run not only our ministry, but it's almost like we as independent Baptists don't have enough to do. Instead of pastoring our church, we have to pastor all the other churches in the area as well. It's seemingly that way because when you get with pastors' meetings, many times it's caught up with talking about each other. What does that do to the use of edifying? There's a lot of meanness in our ranks. And as a result of that, you find a lot of that in our church bodies. We ought to have a church body that is not marked by being mean. It ought to be marked by something very different. What should it be marked by? Look at verse 32. If we're going to put off meanness, then what should we put on? It says, "And be ye kind one to another, tender-hearted, forgiving one another, even as God, for Christ's sake, hath forgiven you." When it comes to people that have done wrong, now I'm not talking about stupidity. If you're on the job site, you're going to have to deal with things. I find that many people that are foolish in their actions don't want anybody holding them accountable. I'm not talking about that. But you can be very firm and yet still be very kind. Now, this is an area that I struggle in. I'm just being transparent with you. I can find when I'm struggling spiritually because this is an area I struggle in. Well, that's right, preacher, you do. And you know what? So do you. So just get off your high horse. I'm admitting my wrong. How come you're not admitting yours? Why? Why should we be kind to one another? Why should we be tender-hearted toward one another? Why should we be forgiving toward one another? He gives the motivation at the end of the verse. This is why. Because God, for Christ's sake, has been that way with you. He's the one who laid down His life. And I thought about it. He did that for me. And I thought about all the ways that I have offended a holy God. The things that I've done. Those things that I've said. The thoughts that I have thought. He knew all of those on the cross. When He was in the Garden of Gethsemane, He said, "Lord, if it be possible, let this cup pass from me." He didn't want to do it on a personal basis. It wasn't something that He was relishing, but it's something He did because it was the Father's will and it was His love for us. Knowing every single thing that you have done to offend Him, every little sin that He sees, the thoughts and the intents of the heart, and He died for you even in the midst of that. He hung naked before the world for you, the very Son of God. He took the plucking of the beard. He took the spittle running down His face of strangers He had never met. He took the mocking of the Roman soldiers. He took the criminal making fun of Him on the cross. I think you can forgive her, can't you? Husband, can't you forgive her? Wife, I think you can forgive your husband. Well, he may be a jerk, but I think you can forgive him. Parent, I think you can forgive that child. Child, I think you can forgive your parent. I think you can handle this when you think about what Christ did for you. What He's asking you to do in the area of forgiveness and kindness does not hold a candle to what He's done for you in your life. There ought to be something distinctive. Our morality. Are you living a righteous life, Christian? Listen to me, men, young men. The pornography issue, it's killing you. It's killing you. It's destroying you from the inside out. It's gutting you. Give it to Him. I'm sitting in an auditorium tonight. You're sitting here. Can I tell you, of the men here, 60% of you are viewing pornography. It's just a part of our society. Give it to Him. We ought to be distinctive in our morality. Our moods. I'm saying y'all not to get angry, but the rage has got to go. It has to. It's not healthy. It's destroying your home and your marriage. Your usefulness for God. There's no excuse for it. Our mouths, the way we speak to and about other people, it ought to be different. Our money, the way we handle it, the reason we're trying to get it, it ought to be different. Our manners. We ought to be kind, gracious, and forgiving to one another. That is the lifestyle of the righteous and faithful.